Take it away.
So I'm Andrew Black. I'm here wearing my jacket because Eric wanted to be embarrassed or something. As John Cleese would say, now for something completely different. You've been hearing about all sorts of advanced language features and really clever stuff, and Grace isn't any of that. The whole idea behind Grace is to be as simple as possible. So we're going to tell you about a boring language with no new features and no way of using language features that's new. And the reason for that is that Grace is designed to be an educational programming language for teaching the first one or two introductory computer science programming courses. The instructors have to be able to understand this as well as the students. We want to support a variety of approaches to teaching. We're not trying to push a single teaching philosophy, because each time we make a decision that excludes part of the teaching community, we're narrowing our potential user base. So we want to support objects first, but also teachers who would introduce functions first and move to objects later. We want to support both typed and untyped and gradually typed programming and a transition between them. And we also want Grace to be to give you an easy transition to other languages. Once you've understood the concepts, you should be able to transfer them. Something that's often puzzled me is why students who'd learn, say, C++ couldn't then transfer those concepts to another OO language. And the conclusion I came to with after long discussions with my colleagues is if they'd really learned the concepts, then they would have been able to transfer them. But they hadn't. They'd learned pattern matching. They'd learn how to make a C++ program or a Java program or whatever work without really understanding what was going on. And if you go to another language like Smalltalk that was superficially different, but really had an object model underneath that was very similar, they didn't know what to do. And my goal as a teacher is to get those concepts over. Whatever language I teach them is going to be gone in 20 years. Right? But the concepts will still be around. So we want to incorporate the best of last century's technology. Things like closures from 1960-something, assertions, you know, unit testing, traces, tools for finding errors, high-level constructs for concurrency, you know, things like monitors. And concurrency is actually rather difficult because everyone agrees it's increasingly important. We ought to be teaching students how to think about concurrency, except we don't know how to do it. Right? And whatever approach we pick is probably not going to be right. There's certainly no consensus on the right way to teach concurrency. There's no consensus on the right way to do concurrency. So Grace is probably going to have to incorporate a number of different approaches in perhaps in incompatible language levels. We'll talk a little more about that. Support for immutable data, because that's the easy case. And immutable data is the distributed systems programmer and the concurrent programmer's secret weapon. Right, all the hard problems go away if the data is immutable. So whenever we can use immutable data, let's do that so the language should make that easy. One of our design mantras has been, let's make the good thing easy. You can't normally make the bad thing impossible, but at least let's make the good thing easy. And we wanted generics done right. We've been influenced by static languages like Eiffel, Java, C#, Scala, and also by the dynamic world, by the Smalltalks, Python, Scheme, Racket, and so forth. But we've tried not to invent, we've tried to synthesize, but every so often, it seemed like we had to invent something. So the simplest programs are indeed simple. Hello World in Scala looks like this. It says print hello world. I said Scala. What does it look like in Scala? So it just looks like print hello world. And we make that work by silently sort of injecting the top level code inside a default object. So we wrap, if you just give a statement at the top level, you conceptually wrap object around it, and that program is that object. And the initialization of the object is the hello world statement. So that's an object with zero methods and one statement. And objects can contain code that's executed when they're created. So hello world is hello world. You can also do top-level methods. So if you want to do just start with functions, apart from the fact the keyword says method, that will work too. So we can define a function, a method, I mean, Celsius to Fahrenheit, which is in this default object. And we can print out a statement like that. we thought a little bit conceptually. What you're seeing here is a string with an expression interpolated in the middle, right? And that's quite a complicated thing, but it looks actually really simple when you show it to someone. You don't have to explain a whole lot, and it will work, right? And then later on, because the first thing students are going to do is obviously print stuff out, and we want to make that easy. And this is, I think, easier to read and easier to write than a long string with concatenation operators and two explicit two-string conversions and so forth. So that happens automatically. Types are optional. So here's that same method with type annotations. Because types are optional, types don't change the runtime semantics. They may change the pragmatics in that erroneous code will typically do something different when you've got types turned on. But the correct code will still do the same thing. So the program that decides whether typing is static or dynamic or some place in between, and all the options are type safe in the sense that you may get a runtime error rather than a compile time error, but you won't disintegrate into a rubble of bits. Clean concepts. Well, we try to make them as clean as we can, and we also try to make them simple as we can. So we decided, following a number of other languages, that we were going to have numbers. Now, we weren't going to have ints and big ints and floats. So there are numbers, and they're exact. Unfortunately, because of the way God made the universe, not all numbers are exact. So things like square roots and pi are going to be approximate numbers, and the students are going to have to know that some things are approximate. But 7 over 4 and 1.414214 are exact numbers, and they're rationals. And if you multiply them and divide them by the right things, you'll get back the number you started with, which is really what people ought to expect if they haven't already been indoctrinated. We have objects because we're an object-oriented language. That's an object. Actually, more strictly, that's an object constructor or an object literal. When you execute it, you get an object. Right? And that object has got, guess what, two methods. One's called radius and the other's called area. Right? And the radius is 5 and the area is whatever that evaluates to. We also have constants. They seem like good things to have. So def const equals is a constant definition. On the right-hand side is an expression. On the left-hand side is a name. So we can say def disk equals the object I just showed you, and that's how you name an object. Okay. Doesn't seem too hard so far. Objects can also have constants inside them, and they're accessed in the same way as methods. So we can say disk.radius or disk.area, and they answer the right numbers. And it doesn't matter if we've defined disk to be an object with a def inside or a for radius or a method inside for radius. Right? That's information hiding. Whether the answer is computed or stored is none of your business. Right? It's my business as the implementer of the object. It's not your business as the client. And that's true, of course, for more complicated methods. So I don't think I have examples on the slide, but field update is a method, and it looks like field update, but it actually invokes a method, and you can override that method and get it to do something else if you want to. So again, from the outside, you don't know when you're setting the speed of a vehicle, whether you're just setting an instance variable or whether it's executing code. That's an implementation decision. Object factories. So we argued about this quite a bit. In principle, we don't need anything special for object factories because we've got lexical scope in the good old ALGOL 60 style. So here we see a definition of a thing called a disk. It's an object. It's got one method. That method is called of radius. Right? The result of that method is another object. That object has got a radius method, an area method, and a greater than method. So I can do this sort of stuff. I can define my disk to be a disk of radius 7. And you might think of a disk as being a class and of radius being the constructor. Or you might just think of it, well, it's an object and it's got an object that's produced when I... And here's a method that returns an object. That's not unusual. Most methods return objects. So here I've made two different objects by invoking the same method. And they're both instantiations of the same object constructor. But objects don't actually... The relationship between those two objects is they were both made in the same way. They happen to have the same fields. They've got different values and so forth. Alternatively, you can use a thing called the class syntax, which essentially codifies that pattern. And you might find this simpler to teach because there's less text on the slide. But it really does the same thing. We have the constructor method called of radius. It has a parameter r. And the result of executing that method is to return the stuff inside the curly braces, which is the object. So it does the same thing. And our feeling was that some instructors would want to introduce classes early and others would not want to introduce them at the beginning and just start with objects. Again, you've got your choice. All right. But yes, please ask questions. I was about to say, I hear a silence. Please ask questions.
Does this define both identifiers, a disk and a radius?
A disk is the name of an object, and of radius is the name of a method on the object, the constructor method.
And this code defines both of those identifiers?
Yes, yes. So we had thought that initially all of the constructor methods would be called new. But the more we played around with the design, we decided it made sense to let the user name them something reasonable. So that's why the name's there. But you can call them all new if you want to.
So I notice you've chosen to make it sort of expression-oriented. Is that a deliberate thing?
Expression-oriented rather than statement-oriented?
Yes, because there's no return.
Yes, so there is actually a return statement, but you need it only if you want to do an early return. So if you want to return from the then branch of an if, you actually say return. If you drop through to the end of the method, then the value you return is the last value that you computed. And if you think that's wrong, let us know. It seemed like the right thing to do.
Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but what does return mean inside of a closure?
It means exit the method, not the And that's why you need it. It's just a small talk design, essentially. But if we, since we all, I haven't told you this yet, but all of our control structures are implemented as methods using closures. So if you don't have a way of exit, a non-local exit, things get complicated quickly. And exiting the method being the only non-local jump encourages you to have small methods. That is the style that we want to encourage students to use anyway. There's somebody over here with a microphone.
So you're making these choices like being expression-oriented and having, anonymous objects that you can return, and these are very powerful language decisions, but a lot of the object-oriented languages don't actually support these features. So as an educational language, do you think it's wise to give students features that they'll later miss when they get to like real languages?
Absolutely it is, yes. I mean, if the students aren't able to distinguish between languages that give them features and languages that don't, we've got sort of the least common denominator language, a set of language features. It's not going to be a very interesting language. We want students to experience powerful features. And if certain languages don't have them, then what do? You learn how to work around that in that language. So if you have a language that doesn't have a lambda, for example, what do? There's a coding pattern in that language to simulate it, right? And you learn that this language is therefore less convenient to use than the other one. Was that such a bad thing? Well, maybe we'll get more people on the Java design committee to actually put lambdas in the language. I suspect that Java will have lambdas long before Grace is widely used in teaching. So it's taking a long time, but it's probably going to take us just as long.
So I wanted to make sure I understood your answer to Neil's question. If I have a closure and I use return, do I by default return from the closure, or do you actually implicitly close over return from the name of the method that
return,
I was
you
in?
You return from the method.
Okay.
And we had, I had toyed with the idea of having, you know, labels on scopes so you could say which one you're returning to, but we haven't done that. You return from the method. And methods can't be nested directly, so you always return from the enclosing method. That's a runtime error, right? If you return a closure that has a return inside, then if you try and execute it, you can't return from that method because you're not in it anymore, so it's a runtime error. Yes. Okay.
So I noticed from the greater than method that you seem to have self and I suppose Java style implicit self-references, like on radius there.
Yeah.
And you also have lexical, I mean, you also have closures, which means lexically scoped names.
Yes.
And, I mean, there's just a technical question of how do you resolve those two styles, which one wins. But there's also, from a teaching perspective, I would think it makes those two concepts are somewhat difficult. Each independently are somewhat difficult, and when they intersect like this, that could be a
We've
problem.
Gone around this circle quite a few times. So the problem is there can be a method on self called radius. There can also be a lexically scoped variable potentially called radius, and which do you get? One way of disambiguating that is always to make message sends in the Smalltalk sense method requests is the Grace terminology. Method request explicit by saying self.radius, and that would be a method request. Whereas if we had a local lexical variable radius and just said radius, that would be accessing it. We've resolved this problem by saying they don't conflict. Right? You're not allowed to. Is that right? We've banned it. Right? So we've banned shadowing in general. You can't redeclare in a scope something that's visible in the outer scope. So for an industrial strength language, that's probably the wrong thing to do because, I can't move this code into some context that somebody else gives me without having to rename the identifiers. In terms of explaining to students what's going on, it's probably the right thing to do. And, you can't redeclare that here because now it's ambiguous which of these things you mean, so you have to change the name. So that's the decision we've made. So let me move on a bit, make sure that I give Kim enough time. The last thing I wanted to talk about was reusing objects. So you can obviously do object composition. Here's an object. It's sort of a washer. It's got a hole in the middle, and it's got an outside, and they're both disks. And the area now is the outside area versus minus the hole area. Other thing that's actually important to readability that I hadn't spoken of is we have multipart method names, sometimes called mix-fix syntax. So the name of this method here, this constructor method, is hole diameter, open close, outer diameter, open close. Right? So trying to make readable sentences. So that's the class that generates the object like that. But we can also, of course, do inheritance, because inheritance is one of the things we have to teach. And inheritance is essentially done by Tal Vasari's copy down semantics. So we inherit from a particular object. This solves the super object initialization problem. Right? We're inheriting from an initialized object. Its radius has been set. We copy its methods. We copy its fields, but the fields are already initialized. And now we can add some more fields like height and volume, more methods to it. And we can do that with a class as well. So the inheritance story can easily be explained by pictures of objects being copied, or as well as by denotational semantics or whatever your favorite formalism is. Deathly silence. So at this point, I was going to hand over to Kim. Oh, I think. Oh, yes, there was a couple more. we've also talked about whether we want multiple assignment and multiple returns and tuple returns, or whether tuples are values. And current status is that we don't have tuples and we don't have multiple returns. And if you want to return more than one thing from a method, well, you can, of course, return an object. And because we've got object constructors, you know, to return an object with two fields, you don't have to have a separate file with a class and then make one of these objects and initialize it. You can just write the expression like this. And it's not nearly so cumbersome. It's still not quite as neat as just returning the two expressions, but it seemed like a reasonable compromise. So here we're answering an object that's got two methods, base and extension. I'm defining them as names, but they're accessible as methods. So that's, again, something where we've looked at different alternatives, and there's always trade-offs to be made, but that's where we're sitting at this moment. And you want the microphone, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, all modern languages have closures. So let's talk about closures. Grab from Smalltalk way back when. So closures can have parameters or not. So the thing in curly brackets is a parameterless closure, print hello. We can also have closures that take parameters, x, y, and returning whatever it is that it does. These closures will be represented for us by objects with an apply method. So the second example there with the x and y parameters essentially gets translated into this object with an apply method that takes the x and y and uses real lexical scope for this. Once we have that, we can build our own control structures, which is pretty handy. So if we're defining a list class, which of course really would be sitting in a library somewhere, we could have a method for each or a map or whatever, and we can simply pass to that a kind of closure and then apply it. We have mylist.forEach, and we pass it a closure of the appropriate functionality, and it will do what it's supposed to do along that. One important thing is, after some discussion, we decided to make some things visible in the language that typically are not visible, in particular, delayed evaluation. So, for example, if we have a conditional statement, well, obviously, we're going to evaluate the condition, but we're not necessarily going to evaluate C or D, so those normally go in curly brackets. On the other hand, if we have a while loop, the sum cond in there is something that is going to be evaluated many times, possibly many times. So having that in curly brackets as a piece of code that is going to be re-executed later on seemed to be a very useful kind of thing. This led us to some decisions that may seem odd to you. So for example, else if kind of constructs. So because we are not going to be evaluating the other conditional unless sum cond turns out to be false, that also is contained inside curly brackets. So I don't know of any other language that really does this in this way, but it did seem to be a useful thing for students to understand when code is executed. And certain pieces of code will be held off, either not executed at all, or perhaps evaluated much later along the way. There are some other features, some decisions that we've made that are perhaps, well, are different from other languages. So types for us are interfaces. They are not classes. Okay? We also use a structural typing rather than nominal typing along the way. So in fact, one cannot use a class as the type of a particular variable along the way. Visibility, we're currently thinking of only having two options, either public or confidential. Confidential being the kind of the like protected in Java-like languages. We're going to have support for immutable objects, basically ways of labeling them, ensuring that, in fact, they will be immutable. And we're still toying with the idea of how to deal with equals and hash code. Something I discovered the other day as I was teaching my data structures course is that Eclipse now has a way of automatically generating for you both equals and hash code. You simply tell it what you think is important, and it will generate the equals method for you, basically the right one that you would have written if only you were patient enough to write it correctly, and the hash code that it will generate. So we're going to do, we're not quite sure whether we're going to put that in the IDEs or have that as part of the language. Obviously, people can override that if they want, but that will be there. Andrew already mentioned that numbers consist of the of rationals, exact numbers, as well as the binary 64 kind of floats along the way. Now, one interesting part of this collaboration between the three of us is that there's actually very little we agree on, which has made this really interesting. And this comes particularly with typing disciplines. So we have, there are different ways you can look at things. Now, Andrew is there in his tie and his sport coat. Andrew, I would label as the flower child among us. He believes in dynamic typing. Do what you want. We'll make sure it's safe at runtime. And if things crash, well, we'll figure out what happened. We'll have ways of going back and figuring that out, and we can decide how we want to deal with that. Then, of course, there's the Types Regulatory Commission, which will only allow you to do certain things. That's the static typing discipline. We'll make sure we can prove everything's going to be safe before we let you do it. That's me. And then, of course, there's a lot of things in between. But the key thing is, no matter which of these disciplines we have, we want to really get the same answer. Though, of course, if you have a static typing discipline, it may say out of hand that certain programs just can't be run. Okay? And those that might be run under a more dynamic typing, you know, obviously we'll be getting some different results since the other ones can't run at all with this. It's going to be very important to us that these disciplines can interoperate. This is especially true as we think of building libraries. Mixing the disciplines helps the students to migrate. There are a number of people who like languages like Python in particular because they don't have to worry about writing down type information at the very beginning. They want to introduce types more gradually to students. With this, we can kind of gradually move those in along the way, that they can move from dynamic to statically typed language. Maybe even when they shift courses, they may move dramatically from totally dynamic to totally static, but it's basically going to be the same core language underneath that. That brings up interesting questions of what does a type annotation mean in a dynamically typed language, where normally you don't see such things. For us, it's simply going to, it represents a claim, something that can be dynamically checked, and we can essentially turn a knob to say what we want to have done if it happens to fail. There may be some who want to say, well, it failed, let's record that, but let's just go ahead and see what happened. Maybe my annotation was incorrect, and others who would like to stop at that point. But in this way, it's very much like an assert statement along the way. Of course, in a statically typed language, it's a provably correct assertion. It's one of the triumphs of theorem proving that we can actually prove static typing for these languages. Okay, let me talk a little bit about some advanced features. Pattern matching, the first example we have of a match here is really just like a regular case statement. And you'll notice that the curly brackets are strategically placed here because we have these three cases and we have the code that will only be executed if we get the appropriate match here along the way. This is the simplest type. We can also use it with variant types. Okay? Our object types, by the way, do not contain the null value. We listened to Tony Hoare talk about his billion-dollar mistake. So our object types do not have a null. If you want a null, make one up. Okay? So we can define, for example, a not there, which is an object which will have whatever kind of methods we like. We can define a type result, which is going to be a string or not there, where we kind of implicitly understand not there as a singleton type for this. We can then use the variant types, for example, in a match statement. So here we are emulating kind of looking up a key in a table where it may or may not appear. If it happens that we get a V, which is a string, then we'll do the appropriate things with it. If not, if it's not there, then we'll do something else. And by the way, the fact that that we have a variant type lets us check that, in fact, this is going to be exhaustive in this particular case if the type value of key returns that variant type of result along the way. Okay, we have been discussing whether we want something more powerful on the nature of Scala's pattern matching, the kind of thing that one finds in functional languages where you get a list and it would be automatically decomposed with pattern matching into the head and tail, or the extract kind of function that you find in Scala, but then it's easy enough just to call a method and get that as well. So we're constantly looking at the balance between expressiveness and simplicity, thinking of trying to always keep in mind our intended audience of novices. We are going to have language levels. Some of you may be familiar with Scheme Ratchet, and we were looking at the same kind of language levels. We think we can accomplish this with libraries. The libraries, as usual, package together classes and objects that can be used. A use construct will be used to inherit public features into an object. So our top level, we have an object. If it uses something, then all those public methods come down. We will have use different things to bring down different language features at different levels along the way. We have a lot of work to go to develop these pedagogical IDEs, but that is an important goal for us. So why should you consider using Grace? Well, you probably shouldn't, because if you're just doing professional programming, it's going to be a language that may be lacking in many ways. However, if you're thinking of trying to find a language to teach novices, for me, thinking about the first course, or in particular the data structures course, where I'm particularly frustrated by my language options, advantages here are we have a clean syntax and a very simple uniform semantic model. There are no static features. We do not allow overloading. There is no null. Everything's an object, including our closures along the way. We're going to have generics done right. That is, you can ask it, and it'll know that it really is a list of string and not just a list of something along the way. We have the closures. We have the case and the pattern matching. Syntax that will allow us to design our own control structures as part of library packages along the way. The idea is that will be an easy transition between dynamic and static type checking, that we will have high-level support for parallelism and concurrency. This will almost certainly all be put into libraries and will encourage people to develop a variety of different things. We would like to have libraries that will support the actors model. We'd like it for shared memory as well. Right now, we're leaning toward the kind of constructs you see in languages like Habanero Java, Habanero Scala, being developed at Rice, where we've got asyncs, we have finishes, we have futures, et cetera, relatively high-level constructs for these. And of course, we'll provide support for immutable objects. So the current state of Grace, they're wonderful opportunities for puns with this. It's really hard to resist. So we our plans for 2011 were to have various levels of language releases prototype implementations. There are three implementations that are in progress at various stages at this point. The spec just got released, I think, this morning at 0.35. Our goals for this year is to solidify that, and I think we've been spending a lot of time arguing, and it looks like spinning our wheels, I think we're really making progress now. We hope to have mostly complete implementations by the end of this year. 2013, we should have a good reference implementation, should be experimenting with classroom use. 2014, we hope to solidify this to at least a 1.0 level, start thinking about writing textbooks and recruiting others to write textbooks, looking for people to try these out, and ideally by 2015, we'd have people using this who aren't thinking of it as purely experimental. Okay? We need help. If you'd like to get involved, we need people, of course, we'd love to have enthusiastic people who will also have a good sense of taste, who will critique us when they think we're making mistakes and push us in the right direction. We need programmers, we desperately need implementers, library writers. IDE developers is a very important thing for us because as an educational language for novices, the development environment is going to be absolutely critical, and all the other kind of people that I've listed here. The language will be available. There's a blog about the language at Gracelang, gracelang.org. And let's see, what happened to the other part? Oh, here we go. And it is possible now to take a really experimental version on Grace, which runs in a web browser, which is at the second URL down here, the one from New Zealand. And you can try out things. There are some idiosyncrasies. In particular, we discovered, much to our frustration, as we try copying things from Keynote to their control characters that it seems to get very upset about. But there are a number of sample programs that are available there that you can just load, and you can modify those, you can try out things. The language spec is also available. Current language spec is also available at gracelang.org. So we'd be very happy to hear any comments. We'd love for more people to get involved in this in whatever way that you would like to. There are also mailing lists, et cetera, that you can find out at Gracelang. But let me stop there, and Andrew and I would be very happy to take questions from you. Do we have the microphone? Pick someone.
So as I understand it, you want to boil down the object-oriented features to their bare minimum and make them nice. But then at the end, you mentioned you want to have concurrent features that don't exist in other languages except experimental languages. So it seems like there's a mismatch. Maybe you could explain a bit.
Well, it's our opinion that our students need to know about concurrency. They need to know how to write parallel programs. We're not sure what the right way of doing that, which is why that is being shoved off to libraries, so we can allow lots of experimentation for that. But right now, in the intro course I teach, the students are using threads in a number of places. We make very sure that there are no race conditions. We give them assignments that make sure that doesn't happen. In our second course in data structures, we're actually looking at how we deal with all the problems of concurrency and shared memory sorts of situations. So we think that students are going to need to see this early and often in their undergraduate career, and we want to make it possible for instructors to put them in. It is not part of the core language, but we think that it's important that the language support these, and we should be able to put in other things, other ways of doing things as we learn it. It seemed important not to leave that out.
More questions? So,
I'll take the one that's nearest. And then I'll...
Did you have the opportunity to show these to students and see what their reactions is?
We haven't had a chance yet because we haven't had a good implementation that is available to them. That is, I've had some students who are working on this. I'm going to have a student who will be developing all the usual examples that we use in our introductory program this summer, and then we'll be getting more reaction from students. But no, we feel like we need something that they can actually work on before we can get much feedback from them. On the other hand, I've been teaching introductory courses for about 35 years now, so I've had a fair amount of experience with what students do and don't understand, but we're flexible enough. I mean, I was talking to somebody earlier. One of the curses of a language developer is that you have users who don't want things to change. So we're trying to kind of slowly introduce this and not solidify things until we've gotten that kind of feedback.
Are you familiar with Touch of Class and the book that Bertrand Meyer wrote for teaching Eiffel as an introductory programming language?
I've heard him lecture on that several times. I haven't looked at the actual book. I didn't know. Is the book out now?
Oh, yeah, for more than a year.
Oh,
and
okay.
I'd be interested to talk to you about
okay.
You did not choose Eiffel for this instead of creating a...
Yeah, and Eiffel is one of the languages that influenced us in the design. There's a lot of nice things in there. Go ahead.
So a couple of things are kind of related with respect to them, how you've chosen to interpret the meaning of names. You didn't mention mutation or assignment at all. So the name of a variable, I assume, is just its value in it. And you can't assign to it. And then the related thing is the name of a method is the evaluation of that method. So is there a way to refer to a method as a function?
Let's see, so you can wrap up a method invocation inside a closure. So you can certainly make it into a closure in that way. But I think at one point we had discussed making them automatically closures, but decided against it.
So methods are not objects. They're not first class in that sense.
Right.
An object, the method, is subsidiary to the object that owns it. But your first question, I just realized none of the examples on the slides used var. They are variables,
yes.
And they are assignable. So you can have variables, local variables in blocks, and you can also have fields in methods, in fields in objects, and the fields are assignable. Right? And if that assignment appears as a method which can be exported or it can be confidential. So you can decide whether the clients get to assign to the fields or not.
We'll be able to keep taking a few questions while we swap over here.
Okay.
And as soon as Bruce is ready, we'll move on to that. I do not know which hand came up first. So I'm just going to select randomly.
So some of the issues with language design only show up with large-scale programs.
Right.
You know, 500,000 line programs. How do you intend to reflect that in this introductory language?
We don't.
So what students do?
They don't learn about the issues of large-scale programs in the first couple of courses. Right? They're learning small-scale programming. So I absolutely agree. There are problems of modularity problems, large-scale problems, and they're going to be addressed typically at the same time the students introduced to industrial-strength languages. However, we are aware that we're going to run into some of the same problems ourselves because we're going to have to generate probably thousands of lines of libraries. Right? So although that's not one of our design goals, we have had extensive discussions about module systems and how we are going to deal with this and how the language levels interact with the modules. But some of the decisions we made, such as no shadowing, are deliberately there for simplifying teaching, acknowledging the fact that it's not probably not the right decision for large-scale industrial language design. Martin.
The semantics of DEF, is that strict evaluation or lazy?
Strict.
And how do you deal with top-level DEFs then?
How do we deal with top-level DEFs? What's...
Well, you probably, your whole program consists of a bunch of DEFs.
Oh, mutually self-referential.
No, I mean, if you have a bunch of DEFs in your files, there's not a natural order in which you would evaluate these. So how do you define that? Or is it all in one file?
File? We're talking about programs, we don't have files.
Source script.
Yes, that's a problem.
Okay. The other thing is, I think one of the worst things that Scala inherited from Java besides null pointers is universal equality. So I would step very, very carefully there. So in retrospect, universal equality is very, very dangerous.
You mean universal equality or object identity?
Universal equality, that essentially everything is comparable to everything.
Everything else.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Bruce still looks busy up there. We can take another one down here.
One more? Okay.
I'd like to understand how inheritance works a little more. So when you have an inherits expression or statement,
yeah,
what are you evaluating on the right side? Is that any arbitrary expression?
No. It might be in a purely dynamic language, but because we also want to support static typing, there are syntactic restrictions on what can be on the right-hand side of the inherit statement. And the current verbiage is something like it has to be definitively static. That is, it's an object, but the compiler has to be able to figure out what's in that object.
I was going to answer. That answers my questions about how that plays with typing and shadowing.
Right.
Anyone else?
Andrew?
Exceptions?
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Exceptional.
You said that type conformance is going to be structural or is structural.
Yes.
Have you considered how that interacts with recursive types? So like if a list has a tail that returns another list, it seems like you either get a very complicated type system or you end up saying it's not structural after you've unfolded it a certain number of levels, or I don't know.
No, the problem with structural types is not recursive types. That seems to be quite simple. The problem is error messages. And the place that people have tried this before they've got into trouble is giving the user intelligible error messages. And smarter people than us, I have to say, have failed to make this work. So that, I suspect, will be a challenge. But it's not the type system itself. Emerald did structural types. That works out quite nicely. It's actually the algorithm's already there in anyone who does nominal types. The algorithm for nominal types is it a structural match, and do the names match? We're just taking away the last conjunct. Claudia?
Yes, I like what you were doing with the control constructs, making the delayed evaluation explicit.
Right.
But then, you are, unless I misunderstood, it looks like you don't distinguish a field reference from a method reference, right?
Right.
So if that there might be some computation happening there when you refer to a field, but not when you refer to a method, but not when you refer to a field.
Right.
And this is one of the features of C# that I find awful, actually, because you don't know that, you know, what right. you're doing is actually not going to do anything.
And we've actually had people tell us, but you don't know whether that's going to cause computation or not. Yeah. And that's right. That's the price you pay for encapsulation.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a design decision.
When I send a message to, you know, Microsoft server and you give me back a result, how do I know whether you computed it or whether it was stored?
So clearly there's plenty more to discuss. Never present a new programming language in a venue like this.
But that's the whole point, isn't it?
That's the whole point. So it's been great. Thank you very much to both Kim and Andrew.